When wildlife biologist Terry Mesmer wants to see the rare bird, the Gunnison sage grouse, he blasts loud rock music from his truck. According to Mesmer, sage grouse expert and professor in the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University, AC/DC won't scare the birds away, but the noisy truck motor will. So he uses the music to cover up the sound of the engine when he drives out to observe them in their natural sagebrush habitat in southeastern Utah. The male birds are infamous for their elaborate mating dance that lures the females.
Is it just the female that feeds the chicks, or are the males all involved in the rearing?
The males are gone. I mean, they're just like, see ya.
I did my dance. It worked. Bye.
I should say one night stand.
Yeah. Okay, pretty much.
Welcome to Science Questions. I am Sherry Quinn.
I am Susie Montgomery.
And this is Elaine Taylor.
Today on the program, we present the Gunnison sage grouse, a bird that has survived for hundreds of thousands of years, that now lives on the edge of survival in a small portion of Utah and Colorado. It was first designated as a separate species from the more common greater sage grouse in 2000.
Since then, the bird has jumped on and off of the federal government's candidate list for designation as an endangered species. Throughout all this time, the bird's advocates continued to fight for the protection of the grouse's shrinking habitat.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service officially submitted their recommendation to list the Gunnison sage grouse as endangered to the U.S. government's federal register.
The proposal opens a 60-day public comment period expiring on March 12, 2013. The service will consider additional scientific information and make a final decision by September whether to list the bird.
Experts join us today to talk about the Gunnison sage grouse and their efforts to prevent the birds from going extinct.
There are roughly only 3,000 to 5,000 Gunnison sage grouse left in the world, and they are all in the Colorado Plateau in Colorado and in San Juan County, Utah, near Monticello, where population estimates are around 200. Join us as we explore this bird now caught in a fight for its existence amidst a political net of federal and state land policy and management.
Seeing a lek of sage grouse is a spiritual experience, says Professor Terry Mesmer.
They're cryptic colored. In other words, they look much like their habitat. A chicken-sized bird, anywhere from 2 to 5 pounds. Imagine a football with feathers and wings. What they've got is the coloration, or the feathers that they've got coloring this football, is kind of like the sagebrush mosaic. What you could imagine now, if you look out across the landscape and you look at a patch of sagebrush where you've got the grays, the browns, and all of these things in there, that's what sage grouse look like.
A lek is basically where the males...
That is Natasha Gruber, one of Mesmer's former graduate students. She defended her master's thesis this December on a Utah population of greater sage grouse. She describes a sage grouse mating dance, which is similar for both species.
These olive-colored sacs that they blow up and make a few noises with, and then they also strut with their tails fanned and their wings brushing against the harder feathers on their chest. The males are trying to show off for the females so that they will breed with them.
So have you seen that?
Yeah.
In person, it must be pretty amazing to
see
that.
Yeah, it is so amazing. It is so amazing.
As we said earlier, the Gunnison sage grouse was only designated a separate species from the greater sage grouse in 2000. This designation was made after a genetic study was conducted comparing the large and small-bodied grouse that would later be designated the greater and Gunnison. The scientists discovered that there was no gene flow between the two species. What this means is that the two kinds of birds no longer mate and that their babies have become genetically distinct from one another.
Gruber's dedicated sage grouse work helped launch her career as a biologist for the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service and for the Sage Grouse Initiative, a collaborative effort among multiple organizations working towards the goal of achieving wildlife conservation through sustainable ranching. I met up with Gruber at a private ranch near her office in Roosevelt, Utah. We sat atop a patch of saltgrass in a field surrounded by hydraulic fracturing sites. Populations of greater sage grouse are known to subsist in this area of the Uinta Basin, But they are under little protection here due to the state's investment in intense energy development, which takes priority. Still, Gruber is dedicated to doing as much as she can to save them.
Seems like sage grouse, once they have you, they have you for good. They don't let you go. Oh, yes. And they're, you know, right now they're in the spotlight all over the West just due to their population declines and then managed under the states, under the Division of Wildlife, basically. And so, like, a lot of entities have collaborated to try to help improve habitat and conserve the species so they aren't listed.
Scientists use a commonly held hypothesis to explain what factors likely led to the Gunnison's genetic distinction from the greater, Gruber explains.
I think a lot is geomorphic barriers and movements. They're not genetically mixing with the sage grouse, so they have become separate species. And then also behavior can separate us, not only genetics, but behavior. When they have reproductively different behaviors, and that can separate a species out too.
Even though there are many more greater sage grouse, about 150,000, they are also struggling to maintain habitat. But the Gunnison sage grouse habitat is at critically low levels. Today, breeding Gunnison sage grouse can be found spread across 8 western counties, including San Juan County in Utah.
The range-wide estimates suggest about 3,000 to 4,000, and that's based on estimates of lek attendance and things. The main population in Gunnison, Colorado, has been doing relatively stable, but the concern is some of these smaller peripheral populations, such as the Monticello Dove Creek population. Those numbers have declined significantly.
The industrial god on the great bayou where they saw it fall. It's the great god burned down in Arkansas, and the hunters beware.
According to Patty Gillette, supervisor of Ecological Services in Grand Junction, Colorado, time was running out for the federal government to make a decision on whether to list the bird as endangered.
There's something called the Multi-District Litigation Settlement, and in 2011, the Fish and Wildlife Service and two environmental groups, the Center for Biological Diversity and the Wild Earth Guardians, came to a settlement regarding listing decisions. Basically, the environmental group said, you have all these species, over 250 species on the candidate list that you haven't addressed. And so the service in these groups agreed to a schedule where over the next 6 years, the service will address, either make a listing determination or withdraw the warranted finding for the candidate for 250 species. And so both the Gunnison sage grouse and the greater sage grouse were part of that multi-district settlement. So for the Gunnison sage grouse, that timeline is to produce a final rule by September 2013.
Aside from the enforced deadline, Gillette describes the main environmental reasons for the proposed listing.
One of the primary threats is the destruction and fragmentation of habitat. And in the case of the Gunnison sage grouse, you know, they require large blocks of sagebrush habitat. And so, you know, we look at both the existing threats, the existing fragmentation, and the threat of future fragmentation from things like urban development, ex-urban development, power lines, roads, those types of things. We also look at disease or predation. We look at the adequacy of existing regulatory mechanisms such as local land use planning or federal protective measures in their land use plans.
Utah officials, including Governor Gary Herbert, are preparing to draft a plan to save the greater and Gunnison sage grouse, a plan that also aims to keep them off of the endangered species list. A listing can hinder state development efforts, and it could also nullify the state's sage-grouse management plan, which in turn would mean less state control over land management decisions in sage-grouse habitat. Nate McDonald, the governor's public relations director, released this statement on Thursday to SQ Radio.
The Public Lands Policy Coordination Office has submitted Utah's conservation plan for greater sage-grouse to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for approval. The plan was developed by Governor Herbert's Sage-Grouse Working Group in cooperation with local working groups in 11 management areas statewide and continues Utah's work to protect sage-grouse over the past 15 years.
Quote, "We are confident the approval process will result in a positive win-win," said the senior policy analyst John Haria. "Enhancing sage-grouse populations, avoiding designation for protection under the Endangered Species Act, and providing for Utah's continued economic health," end quote.
Jim Catlin and Allison Jones of the Utah Wild Project have been following the progress of the working groups appointed by the governor to develop the sage-grouse plan, which largely involves a 4-mile buffer area, or avoidance zone, around breeding grounds and a limit of 5% surface disturbing activities per 640-acre section. Catlin and Jones say overall the plan falls short.
Now, we haven't seen the very final version. We should be seeing that any day, as I understand it. But my sense of being at all the meetings and following this from the beginning is that the state is trying to do the absolute bare minimum to achieve the thumbs up from the Fish and Wildlife Service. And I think they're taking a risk with the plan that they've got on the table now and sort of playing fast and loose with the future of the sage-grouse, because I don't think that the plan is protective enough. It doesn't ensure protective buffers around the leks. So the plan is now written. As long as you try to avoid or minimize or mitigate, you can still do surface disturbance right outside of a lek. That's a problem. And they have some nice language in there about a 5% cumulative disturbance cap in the occupied sage-grouse habitat. But this cap will only apply to new disturbances and not take into account the existing disturbances on the land that are already affecting the population. And this is a problem. I have my doubts as to whether the Fish and Wildlife Service will sign off on this current version. These are questions still to be answered, and it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I'm not a big fan of the plan that I last saw. I don't think it'll do the trick.
Well, I think that one of the problems with the plan is it's vague in what you need to do and when you need to do it. And there's no thresholds or there's no clear goals of how you get there. You want to avoid a disturbance, but if you can't, you want to then minimize it. Well, if you can't do that, you want to mitigate it. So when do those apply? The problem with mitigation for sage-grouse is that this species doesn't do well to be put in newly created habitat. The fidelity of the habitat that they're in now is one of the unique features of this species. They stay where they are. And it's very hard to transplant them. It's very hard to create new habitat and have them move into it. That's not true of other wildlife. There are many that succeed with creating new habitat and then having them use it. And wetlands are a really good example of that. Much of the Bear River watershed, Bear River Wildlife Refuge, is created wetlands in many cases that have done really well. But that doesn't work for sage-grouse, and that's what makes this issue much more different.
And sagebrush is very difficult to grow and takes a long time.
Right.
It takes a long time. And this comes to part of the problems with the state's plan as well. They allow continued reductions of sagebrush. Now, this is generally a negative thing. It leads to population declines where sage-grouse are now found.
Sage-grouse have a unique role in the ecosystem. They rely predominantly on sagebrush to survive in the winter. Mesmer says they can even gain weight from eating this dry, bitter shrub. clearing sagebrush for development and ranching has contributed to their decline.
Sagebrush, that's what they eat. That's what provides the primary cover. They've got a unique digestive system. They don't have a crop, if you will, like a, you know, a chicken-like bird like the ringneck pheasants, where it's got a gizzard and it grinds up the stuff. And so they exist primarily on soft plant materials. And so they've got an elongated digestive system designed to eat that. They're, in a lot of ways, the barometer of how the sagebrush ecosystems are going. They become a species that is becoming the most visible regarding the effects of habitat loss. And so in some ways they have become that sentinel species, that canary, if you will, that gives us some idea on how maybe the habitat is going for the rest of these species. And sagebrush ecosystems have been defined as one of the most threatened ecosystems in the world because of the significant loss of sagebrush. Now, all sagebrush is not sage-grouse habitat, but sage-grouse are tied specifically to sage-grouse habitat.
Sage-grouse require a variety of habitat features to be successful. As Mesmer pointed out, sagebrush is key to the Gunnison sage-grouse's survival because it serves as a place for the birds to nest and provides food to eat in the winter months.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service also lists healthy wetland and riparian ecosystems as critical to the health of the grouse. They provide insects to eat, water to drink, and a place where the males can dance.
These ecosystems are critical to the life cycle of the Gunnison sage grouse, which begin with males strutting and vocalizing on leks in the spring to attract females. This can start as early as February.
Leks are those areas where the males, they concentrate during the spring to conduct the annual mating ritual. And so the males, as all leking species with, you know, prairie grouse or prairie chickens, they concentrate on an open area and they attract the females in, and that's where most of the breeding activity is done. Leks, or strutting grounds in the case of sage grouse, are located in areas where there's suitable nesting habitat because the males clearly aren't going to be leking in an area where females aren't located. And the females tend to roost and exist in those areas where there is nesting habitat.
Females begin to nest between April and July. However, the Gunnison sage grouse have high rates of predation and nest desertion.
They have a very low reproductive rate. You know, some of the birds, like a quail or something, will have 20 eggs, and it may actually re-nest a couple times during the year. But a sage grouse typically will nest once, and they produce maybe 6 to 7 eggs. And so the key to survival of that species, it has to live a long time. It's not a bird that you have such a high productive rate that they, you know, an adult hen continually replaces itself. But a bird may lose a clutch, and that's the last, that you get one shot. And so then for them to, you know, be successful and pass on their genetics, they have to live another year. And so we have some birds that have lived 6 or 7 years and been very successful, but we have other birds that, you know, have not been very successful. You know, in some cases, it's just the luck of the draw.
Just as the sand made everything round, just as the tar seeps up from the ground, bearded dancer ever turning, so was the day that you came to town.
Sometimes it can seem like endangered species within our country are a thing of the past. I mean, wolves have been so successful that some states are permitting hunters to hunt them. The buffalo is another great comeback story. So how did the Gunnison sage grouse go so long without recognition or protection?
Well, first and foremost, what's happened is these birds rely on sagebrush habitat. When you lose that habitat, when you lose a contiguous habitat base of sagebrush, by whatever means, whether it's urbanization, whether it's agriculture, whether it's fire, what that does is it causes a breakage in the linkage that these birds need to survive. And so fragmentation has been caused by a lot of different factors out there, but it's clear that we've lost a lot of that habitat base. And as that habitat base shrinks and as the connection between these population disappears, you may have bastions or you may have areas of good quality habitat where the birds are pretty much relegated to use. And so the connection, the corridor between source populations and these other habitats has been lost because of that fragmentation. And so when that happens, those smaller populations are at greater risk of extinction than a larger source population just because of sheer numbers.
It's actually kind of scary to look at a map of the Gunnison sage grouse's habitat. Instead of having a vast connected range, their territory appears like polka dots across eastern Utah and western Colorado. Each population is essentially cut off from the other grouse, putting them in increased danger for extinction.
When we look at climate change as a listing factor, it really was, you know, 5-10 years ago, it was really down on the number in terms of the threats. You know, the higher threats were these things we talked about, fragmentation, lack of mechanisms to protect fragmentation. Climate change was listed very low, but as we learn more and more about the effects of climate change, that alone could be pretty disastrous. For example, in some cases right now where we've got maybe suitable habitat, if we had a fire that went through that area and resulted in burning out the entire sagebrush stand, the chance of restoring that, giving changes in climate, changes in precipitation pattern, are going to become that much more difficult. And so climate change is one of those mechanisms that's happening out there that there's not been a lot of research to determine on how it might affect sage grouse populations. But we know, given the risk of fire, given the need for restoration, given changes in precipitation patterns, that if we lose some of these habitats because of wildfire or invasive species, the chance of restoring them in the face of changing climate is going to be that much more difficult.
Other human-made aspects of the sage grouse habitat have created unexpected dangers for the birds.
To a sage grouse, a fence might be a tall structure. I mean, you're talking of a bird that's probably, you know, 12, 15 inches in height, and you're talking of a fence that could be, you know, 4 or 5 feet high. And so in some cases, that might pose a specific threat. And so when we look at fencing and we look at things like utility lines and things along that line, the concern is that those areas might provide perches. They might provide avenues where you know, predatory species, avian predators might use those areas to search and locate landscapes and maybe key in on birds, particularly at critical times of the year, like during the winter, when birds tend to be concentrated. But the key thing when you've got areas where you've got habitat fragmentation or reduced habitat, and you've got a large influx of potential predators, avian predators, you want to be very conscious about what you're putting on the landscape, that it doesn't in some way serve to increase the risk of predation. In the case of Gunnison sage grouse, one of the really, really critical things for this population is that winter habitat. In years of low snowfall, mild weather conditions, these birds have a lot more sagebrush available to them. But when you start getting 2, 3, 4 feet of snowfall on the level, then they're only relegated to those areas that has the taller sagebrush plants. And so if these birds are concentrating in taller areas, or in areas where we've got taller sagebrush, which are a smaller part of the landscape, guess where their raptors are going to focus on? They're going to focus on hunting those areas. And so they could have a tremendous impact on a population that only has a small part of that habitat available as winter habitat because the rest of the habitat is covered by snow.
Fences pose more of a danger than just a place for birds of prey to land.
If you place a fence in an area where you've got a lek and the fence is obscured by the ridgeland, the chance of birds leaving and coming into that lek, hitting that fence, are going to be pretty high. And so the idea is you don't put a fence in an area like that where you've got it obscured and where you have the risk of birds hitting the fence. If you've got fences in areas where birds, there's a potential for a bird strike or a bird hitting that fence, you can actually modify the fence by putting devices on them that spin and move in the wind and actually create a visible effect that these birds can see and they can actually then avoid.
The small population of Gunnison sage grouse sometimes seems to be losing the fight to exist into the future. But speaking with Terry Mesmer gave me hope for these football-shaped birds, especially when he explained the importance of things like livestock grazing, something that I assumed would be detrimental to the sage grouse.
The question is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in their decision regarding Gunnison or regarding greater sage grouse and other sage grouse has really not identified livestock grazing as a landscape level threat. So in a lot of areas, livestock grazing can be really, really beneficial. For example, it can be used in some areas to reduce thick stands of cover, open it up a little bit. It can be also be used in some areas to strategically place and achieve, you know, a certain kind of ground cover or mosaic in that landscape. And so it can be also used to maybe get rid of some vegetation. Maybe we don't want in the area. For example, some areas there may be a real extensive grass cover, and what you want to do is you want to open that up. You want to create more of a shrub mosaic with forb canopy cover. And so using livestock in an area can be very strategic in terms of achieving some of those particular effects. And so there are also things that if you graze at the wrong time, the wrong place, wrong location, it can be detrimental to the sage grouse and other wildlife. But all in all, you know, prescribed targeted grazing can be very beneficial to Gunnison sage grouse and other grouse species.
I think this point is particularly important, especially in Utah, where wildlife activists and natural resource advocates are so often pitted against each other in the media. As for why it took the Gunnison sage grouse so long to be listed as protected, that is nearly as complicated as the reasons behind their habitat loss.
Before the U.S. government places an animal on the endangered species list, it must first be placed on the candidate list to become an endangered species.
In the case of the sage grouse, the service decided other animals were in greater danger of becoming extinct. So the sage grouse were moved down the list to make room for these other species to more quickly move from the candidate list to the threatened and endangered list.
I came down over the sleeping mountains where white toes plunged into the weeping shelter terror. Skin up off from the bottom, leaves our ankles bare. They'll just wander back and forth and leave it.
For Terry Mesmer, engaging locals who are in contact with the sage grouse is the most important aspect of their future survival.
In order for conservation to be successful, you first of all have to have a level of awareness. In other words, you have to engage all aspects of the community in understanding the biology of the species affected, the habitat. And by doing so, by taking people out into the landscape where you can actually see, look, you can touch, you can feel, you can smell, you can handle the animal, you develop awareness. And awareness is really, or you develop an appreciation for that species. And it's just pretty cool seeing something like sage grouse out there, knowing that during the spring they do this lekking ritual. That's an age-old ritual that was thousands and thousands of years in the making for perpetuation of the species. And so the fact that you have that going on your land, on your property, creates a real sense of awareness about that species. And I think once you have that awareness, that leads to appreciation.
In fact, that is exactly what happened with private landowner Lawrence Wetman. When Wetman learned he had a nesting population of Gunnison sage grouse on his ranch in Monticello, he organized an interagency collaboration with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Natural Resource Conservation Service, and the Division of Wildlife Services to restore the land for the sake of the bird. Professor Terry Mesmer has visited Wetman's ranch to study the bird and the habitat. The three of us met at a Salt Lake City Denny's to try and figure out what to do next.
I put, you know, just different types of forbs and different types of legumes like St. Juan and Ranger, Bulldog, and stuff. And so we designed this habitat, and then slowly I'm trying to make the human induction, because it was my belief that if there wasn't a direct benefit on the property, because, you know, I have people that cut my fences down and graze their cows, you know, and with this drought and stuff, I put a well in that would seep into a reservoir to where the birds can get a lot more bugs and whatnot for rearing their clutches. And so it's been a tremendous success as far as the birds are concerned. But politically, I have, you know, just an immense amount of issues that arise from this, you know, just vicariously through this act of conservation.
So if we could replicate what you've got 20 times over in that county, we'd save Gunnison sage-grouse. We would continue the species.
One way local farmers and ranchers have gotten involved is through the USDA's Conservation Reserve Program. Through this CRP program, the U.S. government essentially rents high-risk land from farmers who agree to develop the land into a sage-grouse-friendly habitat.
One of the biggest incentives, particularly in the case of Gunnison sage-grouse, has been the Conservation Reserve Program. The Conservation Reserve Program was developed as a national program by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and so it was not only available for San Juan County, but it was available nationwide. And it provided a mechanism where landowners participating could establish permanent cover. Part of that, they would take land out of production, and then by taking land out of production, it would also reduce surplus crops. In other words, the amount of grain and stuff that was in surplus, and so it would reduce that surplus and therefore maybe help stabilize the market, for agriculture crops. And so that was implemented on a national-wide basis, and it not only benefited, sage-grouse in Utah, but it also benefited waterfowl, pheasants, and other populations throughout the United States. In San Juan County, what happened in the 1980s was this program came in, and basically what it did was provide landowners that were participating in the program a rental agreement. It basically rented the land for a period of time and provided them to establish permanent cover to benefit sage-grouse, and it also provided them some income off the land that would supplant income that was generated from maybe producing or planting wheat or some other crop. And so it restored agricultural land back to some type of permanent cover. So the combination of going in and providing habitat, planting sagebrush, protecting sagebrush, providing that permanent cover, maintaining that cover over time, in conjunction with doing things to enhance the kind of food that's available in that cover are really, really important.
Mesmer adds, there are a lot of other measures to protect sagegrass habitat.
Clearly, sagegrouse have an annual life cycle. I mean, they use certain habitats for nesting, for breeding, and also for wintering. And in a lot of these areas, developing activities or things along that line that would provide mechanisms for protecting these habitats and enhancing these habitats. For example, in some cases, there may be areas where the sagebrush habitat, the sagebrush canopy cover has developed a thick, dense overstory where there's nothing left underneath. There's none of these green groceries. There's none of the vegetation, the insects, or things like that that are required from the standpoint of needing providing habitat for food for the chicks or for the hens. And so in some areas, what landowners have gone in and they've looked at these breeding areas and they've gone in and they've developed areas where they can go in and they can open up the canopy. By opening up the canopy, what they do is they create areas of habitat where sage-grouse will use. And at the same time, in doing so, what they do is they create similar areas where they've got additional forage, additional livestock forage for their livestock. I've never met a rancher, an executive in oil and gas industry, a transportation engineer, a hunter, a landowner out there that didn't like the idea of having sage-grouse around, that wanted to do everything they can do to make sure that the species are protected. Clearly they're in the business of their business. And ideally it would be nice to think that somewhere along the line that we can kind of come up with some kind of balance in terms of, allowing sustainable growth and development and protection of the species.
Wetman notes he learned to proceed with caution when working under a bureaucratic system.
But the problem, it seems to me, is that there is this huge contest, or whatever you like, for job, you know, protection, with not only within the entities of doing that research, but if I correlate what was going on in the 1930s and the New Deal, well, the protection of the birds, there was all this great research done, you know, between 1933 and 1950, wonderful work, you know, especially in the greater sage grouse. And then, you know, it kind of dissipates throughout the 70s and stuff. And now we have an economic crisis again. And now we have this bird's right in the middle of our economic nightmare that we're going through, the whole shift. And so on one area, I get solicited with different programs to sign up for, but I don't see the immediate benefit, because even building new fences on that side, you know, it costs me $15,000 when they're going to donate, you know, they're going to pay for materials of three. There might be a total of $60,000 that go into that project. Three goes to the landowner to build the fence materials, and the rest goes into auditing, supervising, form filling out. And to me, not having any data, but to me, it is sort of this creating of this bureaucratic system in the hopes of keeping jobs of this sensitive issue, but very little money trickles out to the bird itself. Like, to the habitat, it gets minimalized. So if you get into, if you were a private landowner trying to do this, well, it's 50-50. If you're doing conservation, where I'm a conservationist, I don't really have a net benefit for putting in seed. I'm not going to be grazing cows down there. I have no foreseeable economic system that I'm going to get a benefit in the future. When I have to go 50% on, say, $60,000 of seed, you know, there is no benefit directly to the private land user, but only in improving grazing is what they try to go through. And then you have this huge system, let's say, that seems to consume a lot of the funds that would be allocated towards the bird. But my question would be, what actually finally goes to the bird? What percentage of that?
The future of the sage grouse is not lost, yet. But it is going to require cooperation and compromise among groups that often have conflicting goals.
The community of the science and the industry and business and agriculture communities have been working together for a long time to come up with solutions, innovative solutions on how you can allow certain activities to occur in these habitats. At the same time, you can protect the species. And so there's still a lot of work to be done. You know, clearly, however, we've got to put in place mechanisms that recognize and protect these core and important habitats. A plan for Colorado is not a Utah plan. A plan for Wyoming is not a Utah plan. Each of these populations, even though they share similar biology and similar traits, they experience different threats, different land uses. And so if you're really going to be serious about conserving sage grouse, it has to be focused on the issues and the threats and the landscapes and the culture of the community which you're involved in. And so you can't just plug and play these plans. You have to absorb all of these things, both the social, the biological context, and you have to put those together into something that's going to work for that community and for those birds.
As part of his effort towards community involvement, Mesmer has been taking school children out on field trips to visit sage grouse habitat.
About 15 years ago or so, 20 years ago, I saw a poster and it said, it takes a community to save a sage grouse. And essentially, I think that's pretty apropos, you know. When you look at defining the community, it's just not the community of the biologist and the landowners or oil or gas. I think it's the community of everyone. And that community, I think, also has to include those individuals that will inherit the community. And so that's the children. You know, children are a very big part of that community. They're an inquisitive part. They are the ones that in a lot of ways are going to be tasked with fixing, inheriting some of the things that maybe the previous generation has created. The groups that are most excited about that awareness tend to be school children. We've had experiences this last year where we took a group of young people out to to see elk for the first time, and to see sage-grouse strut. And they were so excited about it that they gave us $200 to learn more about the birds. And you know, those $200 went in to buy a collar for sage-grouse to put on to continue our studies.
So what will become of the Gunnison sage-grouse?
Although the U.S. Fish and Wildlife's strong recommendation of listing as an endangered species makes clear how much destruction has occurred to the grouse habitat, it also provides an even clearer avenue to protection of this rare and beautiful bird.
Hopefully, the Gunnison sage-grouse that today's school children observe and appreciate will fare much better than the sage-grouse of tomorrow that are so threatened.
Why would we allow a harmless species to die if we have an opportunity to save it? That is a question we must consider.
I can remember when I first saw sage-grouse when I was a young person in North Dakota, and I flushed a group of them and they flew. The first thing I immediately thought of was their footballs, their flying football.
A link to the map of the Gunnison sage-grouse habitat we mentioned earlier can be found on our Facebook page. Just search SQ Radio on Facebook. Thank you for listening.
Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn, Susie Montgomery, and Elaine Taylor. Sound engineering by Clint Holgate. And thank you to Aidan Degnan for the music.
We urge you to add your comments about the Gunnison listing to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. For more information, visit fws.gov.
Next, we present this Science Questions special feature on small satellites. These spacecraft are shrinking and making access to space cheaper and faster. Students and engineers at Utah State University in Logan are taking advantage of this booming technology to study solar storms in space that threaten us on Earth. Sherry Quinn has the story.
Imagine a spacecraft as light as your laptop and small enough to fit in your hand. Small satellites, ranging in size from a smartphone to a loaf of bread, are making access to space cheaper and faster. They typically cost 100 times less than traditional satellites that are as large as a school bus. Smallsats are being built for a plethora of practical uses, including the ability to quickly zoom in on potential catastrophic weather systems like hurricanes, floods, and earthquakes, and for studying solar storms that can disrupt everything from communications to airline navigation and GPS systems.
It's been awesome to learn something in class and be able to physically apply it. I started out doing the mechanical design. I've helped wind torque coils and doing the program management and writing software for our ground stations.
That is Eric Stromberg, one of a dozen undergraduate and graduate students at Utah State University, who worked on the project called DICE, which stands for Dynamic Ionosphere CubeSat Experiment. DICE is orbiting the Earth's upper atmosphere. It consists of two identical spinning satellites that are taking measurements of the density and magnetic strength at a particular point in space to ultimately create a three-dimensional map of the space environment. The goal is to learn more about magnetic storms caused by solar flares from the sun. Chad Fish is the Space Environment Manager at the Space Dynamics Lab.
The Earth has this magnetic field around it, and it's actually a protective barrier against what comes out from the sun. And these spacecraft can be affected. They can be charged up, or they can have troubles communicating with the ground. And so our mission is to help understand what is going on and to help predict what can go on in the future.
The sun is made up of plasma, hot ionized gas, interlaced with a maze of magnetic fields. The core of this fiery star is 27 million degrees. This massive furnace makes a lot of noise. This is the sound of its vibrations rippling across the surface, recorded by NASA. It pulsates to set rhythms, ranging from an 11-year solar flare cycle to other ones that span centuries. Satellite pioneer Gil Moore.
The sun starts throwing out these coronal mass ejections.
Coronal mass ejections, or CMEs, are balloon-shaped bursts of solar wind rising above the sun's outer atmosphere.
This solar max is not really very exciting. I was hoping there'd be a lot more stuff going on.
Solar winds stream off the sun at speeds hovering around 1 million miles per hour, and solar flares, a sudden burst of brightness on the sun's surface, pack the same amount of energy as millions of hydrogen bombs exploding at the same time. Moore is working on a project similar to DICE, referred to as POPAX, Polar Orbiting Passive Atmosphere Calibration Sphere. The goal is to measure the effects of solar flares and coronal mass ejections on the Earth's upper atmosphere. The eventual hope is to use this information to decrease satellite collisions and improve the safety of orbiting crew and spacecraft.
Electronic devices get smaller and smaller and smaller, and so they can be damaged by cosmic rays and high-energy protons and stuff coming in from these solar storms more than the satellites did way back when, back in the beginning of the space age. Now, from the debris up there, everything is susceptible. Something the size of your thumbnail could take out a satellite because it's whistling along at 7.5 miles a second.
Even though the sun is 93 million miles away, the radiation it emits hits the Earth every day. Severe solar storms are what cause the concern.
Sun waking from a deep sleep may not sound like such a bad thing, and years ago it might not have been.
Scientists tonight are warning the Earth is susceptible to a major solar storm.
We're not talking about global warming. A brand new government study on the very real destructive threat of solar storms. Now, this giant fireball, if that ball hit the Earth and its magnetic shield, it would be devastating.
The weakening solar storm warning satellite, called ACE, has been in orbit 1 million miles from Earth since 1997.
And it says, hey guys, here comes a biggie, look out!
There is a whole range of potential effects. The most feared one is failure of the power grid. A solar storm in 1989 caused a blackout in the northeastern U.S. and parts of Canada.
Now, if you don't know about it, it can pop all the breakers in your big distribution network. We're in a particular one here called the Bonneville Network. It can shut down Salt Lake City because it pops the breakers and it can burn up lines. I mean, it's just a huge surge of power.
Electromagnetic pulses racing into Earth from violent space weather cause the damage. They can also disable global positioning system satellites that we rely so heavily on for communication, surveillance, and navigation on Earth and in space.
The more we know about solar terrestrial physics, the better off the people on the surface of the Earth are.
Projects like DICE and POPAX that take measurements in space essentially create a 3D map of it, which is helping engineers build stronger satellites and better predict storms that will impact Earth. DICE was funded by a $1.2 million grant from the National Science Foundation and was launched in October 2011. It is sending data back to Earth 5 days a week.
We've been able to show that our satellite and our measurements are seeing things that other missions are seeing, which is a nice feel-good feeling that what we're doing is right. And then from there, we're moving forward and trying to analyze the data and figure out if we've seen anomalies.
Yeah, we've seen some very interesting things that related to interactions of the sun with the Earth, things that are not standard that
right.
happen because something interesting is going on. We're going to start presenting them at conferences and in papers here upcoming. So there's a lot of work to go forward, a lot of science benefit and benefit to the community in general regarding space weather that we expect to come out of this.
The project well surpassed its 6-month mission requirements, and the satellites will re-enter the atmosphere and disintegrate within 25 years.